This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us. Here it is, Trumpet Hour, our week in review program. We have our panel of trumpet writers ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
And Sam Livingston.
Happy to be here.
And from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
And also in Jerusalem, Kieran Underwood.
Thanks for having me.
So this has been quite a jam-packed week in the news. We have a lot to talk about, starting with what seems to have become somewhat of a 4th of July tradition, a provocative missile launch from North Korea. This was an ICBM with a greater range than any that North Korea has used before. Analysts say it actually puts American soil in range. To tell us about this and the international response, we're going to go to Sam Livingston.
Thank you. Like you said there, on July 4th, North Korea launched its most advanced missile to date. They were taunting the United States on the 4th. The leader of North Korea called it a gift to America on Independence Day. This has been a very busy year for North Korea for their missile program. So far, they've tested 17 missiles, and the year is just over halfway over. The special part about this latest launch is that this is their most advanced missile to date. So in response to that, the United States held military drills with South Korea. They were test firing rockets along with them. The big shocker with this latest missile was the distance that it flew, 578 miles into the Sea of Japan. It was fired from the northwest of North Korea. The interesting thing about the way they fired this was they shot the missile straight up. Generally, with a missile like this, you want it to travel the furthest distance possible, so they shoot it at an angle. This one went directly up about 1,500 miles into the atmosphere, stayed up in the air for over 35 minutes. And the big thing about this is they're saying, well, if they didn't shoot it directly into the air and they shot it at an angle, this would give it a range of over 3,400 miles, which is what categorizes it as an intercontinental ballistic missile. This is the first time that North Korea has launched a missile that has the potential to travel that far. It puts Alaska just within that range. I don't think Anchorage, Alaska was quite in there, but nonetheless, there. That Alaska territory is now in range of a North Korean missile, excuse me. So there has been a lot of panic about this, but North Korea still has a long way to go before they develop the technology to actually fit a nuclear warhead small enough onto one of these rockets. So until then, they're just firing these missiles. They're test firing them. That is alarming. That is troubling. But there's still a long way before they're able to develop the technology to actually arm them. Now, the United States is panicking, obviously, because they're in range of these missiles. They're calling on Russia and China to step up to do something about it. Russia and China both say they object to North Korea launching missiles. They're calling for them to put a freeze on the missile program. But then they also said, we're only going to do something if the United States agrees to hold off military exercises with South Korea. So they're using North Korea as leverage over America's presence in the region. They're saying, look, we don't like it, but we're not going to do anything about it until you stop holding drills with South Korea.
Now, that's quite an extraordinary thing for Russia and China to say, considering how big of an issue Donald Trump has made North Korea in his presidency. He's focused a lot of attention on it. Of course, you have the THAAD system in South Korea intended to shoot these missiles out of the sky. And he's been trying to put a lot of pressure on China. Certainly, we've heard less about Russia, I suppose. But for them to say, even after such a provocative missile launch, we're not going to help you out unless you acquiesce to our demands is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, exactly. Russia and China are loving the position that they're in right now because To them, North Korea isn't a threat, and now they can use this as leverage over the United States. And it really backs America into a corner where its only options are to work independently, which would mean a military strike, which would be very difficult at this point, or to turn up sanctions, which would be pretty ineffective against North Korea because over 85% of their trade is with China, and you can't get China to cooperate.
Now, just so we understand, you're talking about the Russia and Chinese response almost as if it's a single response, that they're saying that we're going to work with the United States only upon these demands. Is that are we hearing two different statements from two separate capitals that tend to align, or are they actually speaking as one?
I think the majority of that decision came from China. The bulk of North Korea, they're reliant upon China, but Russia and China both went along in saying that neither of them would do anything until the United States backed away. But predominantly, it's coming from China.
It's just kind of extraordinary to see the alignment in foreign policy between these two countries. Yeah, Andrew.
Yeah, because that is almost kind of the biggest story here is that the possibility of North Korean intercontinental ballistic missile hitting the United States, like Sam said, that's quite a few years off at this point. But seeing how Japan and North Korea are going to respond could have major geopolitical consequences almost immediately. Because obviously the United States, we protect some of the most vital trade routes in the world through our military bases and our alliances with South Korea and Japan. And when you start to see Russia and China start calling shots like this, when South Korea and Japan start realizing that they can't necessarily rely on the United States to protect them from a threat like this and start making alternative alliances, that really has a huge potential to just realign how world trade works in the very near future.
Mm-hmm. Well, very, very interesting. I'm sure we're going to be hearing more about this. As I said, President Trump has made some really strong statements against North Korea, and this certainly increases the tension. There are people, commentators, who are looking at this and saying that we're right on the edge of a line that would lead to war here, and we'll certainly keep our eye on that. We appreciate that, Sam. President Trump has been in Europe this week. He actually started in Poland before traveling over to Germany for a G20 summit. We're going to talk about the G20 summit a bit later. But first, he gave a speech in Poland, his first major speech in Europe, and it was quite an impressive one. It was given to a very enthusiastic crowd there in the capital, Warsaw. To learn what President Trump talked about, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
It was definitely quite an impressive speech. I mean, some political commentators like Charles Krauthammer have said it may actually have been his best speech, Mr. Trump's best speech to date. And he gave this in Warsaw to, like I said, a crowd of Poles that had come to listen, and just really, really eloquently went through a lot of the history of the threats that Poland had been through in the past with the Nazi invasion, and even focusing more on the Soviet invasions and the threat of communism, which is something that politicians don't tend to focus as much on. And then just kind of bringing it up to date, talked about the threats of Islamic extremism today and even the threats of Russian aggression in Eastern Ukraine and Eastern Europe, which is something very important to the Polish people. To my memory, I think that's the first time President Trump's really called out Russia like that. Mm-hmm. Just being out and during the campaign, he was more famous for talking more about how well he'd be willing to recognize Crimea as Russian territory and things like that. So, like Krauthammer said of this speech, in some ways it is quite a different tone than even his inaugural address. His inaugural address was definitely more of like the American first isolationist rhetoric. And this one, he didn't talk so much about America first as he talked about like the free world and the West and how Europe and America need to be banding together against Islamic extremism and Russian aggression, and even saying that he's like does the West have the will to survive? Really, just putting the focus on that they've got the money and they've got the resources, but do they actually have the will to do what it takes to address these threats? And then, of course, by the end of the speech, that was his assessment is like, yes, the West definitely does have the will to address those threats.
Yeah, it was really, really quite a statement. Does the West have the will to survive? And talking about the severity of the threats facing the West, I don't think there are too many people out there talking about survival as being the main issue at stake here. Those are the stakes that we're really up against. That's quite extraordinary for him to put it in those terms. Obviously, as you said, he answered in the affirmative, yes, we do. But I think even the way that he expressed it in terms of Poland's resistance against Nazi aggression and the heroes of Poland's past really making the difference in Poland, demonstrating that it really did have the will to survive. He drew some really interesting parallels there that to me, it was really more about just how far we are from, say, the kind of resolve that Poland has shown in the past than we are close to that kind of a model.
Right. I mean, it was definitely something you don't hear from almost any politicians at Mr. Trump's level of prominence. There might be a handful of conservative journalists. I mean, Melanie Phillips, Charles Krauthammer, Niall Ferguson, who will talk like that. But it is strange and kind of refreshing to see a politician talk like that. But on the other hand, like you say, I mean, I'm sure the polls might have one eyebrow raised a little bit because, I mean, just 6 months ago, he's talking about recognizing Crimea and NATO being obsolete, and maybe he won't defend Eastern Europe if they don't pay their 2%. And then the case in Taiwan, he's talking about, well, maybe we will recognize Taiwan, and took the phone call from the president of Taiwan, and then China put up a fuss and then really quickly backed away from that. And so there's got to be a certain extent where the polls are like, well, great speech, but what are you going to think tomorrow?
That's true. I guess the other thing that just kind of struck me about this is he did praise Poland for being one NATO nation that actually fulfilled its financial obligations to the alliance, and reiterated this message that he's been saying over and over, that Europe must step up and defend itself. And, you know, that message coming from the United States, it just seems like it's been reiterated time and time again, but maybe never stated quite as boldly as it was this week by Donald Trump.
Right. And I believe Poland and Estonia are actually the only two NATO members that aren't the United States that do pay their 2%. So this is definitely a chance for him to try to kind of use Poland as an example to get the other ones to fulfill what they promised to do in the treaty. And as we've pointed out, other places, even though they are legally obligated to pay that 2% if they want to be part of NATO, a country the size of Germany, once they start paying that 2%, they're real quickly in like military superpower style range. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, the one thing you mentioned, maybe the polls were saying nice speech, but it'd be nice to see some action behind this. I just looking at the video of that speech, it was amazing to me how enthusiastic the polls were. They were chanting USA, USA. They were saying Donald Trump, Donald Trump. I mean, it was as close to a Donald Trump rally as you would see, and to see that in a European capital was quite extraordinary. I mean, I think the polls, obviously sitting there in the shadow of the Soviet of Russia, and being kind of sandwiched between them and Europe, they have a lot at stake, and they do really want a strong America to help defending them against Russian aggression. And the fact that he specifically called Russia out the way that you said, that had to have been nice for them to hear. What's interesting, as we move on into our next story, just after giving that speech, where he called out Russia for its provocative actions. This morning at the G20 summit, he actually met with Russian President Vladimir Putin. And what's interesting is in anticipation of this meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson made a surprising announcement regarding America's policy over Syria and how it is actually willing to work together with Russia to determine Syria's future. It's quite an interesting development in light of President Trump's strong words in Poland. To learn about this development, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so there was finally, as you said, this meeting that took place today. I'm not sure exactly how it's going to come out. Come out from the meeting between Mr. Trump and Vladimir Putin. I think the shaking of the hands is their handshake is circulating in social media right now. It looked quite affectionate from Mr. Trump going in, and yeah, what a contrast to how he was speaking yesterday, speaking out against Russian aggression in a way. And now it looks like they are willing to at least work with Russia on the ground in Syria. This is something that we have expected to eventually happen. We've been waiting for the United States strategy in Syria to become evident, and it looks like over the last couple of days it has done through this strengthening of a relationship between the United States and Russia. As you mentioned, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, he put out a statement yesterday. I read through the whole statement, and it was a couple of things stood out to me. One was the fact that it really did not mention Iran that much as being the guarantor of the Syrian state. It was kind of almost praising Russia. Maybe that's a bit too much, too far to say praising, but it didn't really acknowledge how much Iran has done to bolster the Syrian state. It basically said, Russia, you're the reason Assad is still in power. You're the reason the Syrian state still exists. And the, be that as it may, because of you've done that, we want to work with you now on, from now on, once the Islamic State dissolves, to try and organize some type of arrangement in the post-Islamic State world in Syria. He said, quote, working together to establish stability on the ground, talking about their agreements, it will lay the foundation for progress on the settlement of Syria's political future. Let's get together. Let's work this out together. And Russia, you're going to have to be a pretty important part in this.
How big of a departure is this from what we've been seeing from the Trump administration regarding Syria up to this point?
I don't believe it. It has been too much of a departure. It wasn't really stated, though. Their intent to work with Russia wasn't really stated. This is what the pundits, some were saying, was his idea. Maybe we'll get closer to Russia and use the Russian relationship with the United States to try and limit the Iranian hold. That's what America wants the least, for Iran to come out of this in Syria with more power than they had going in.
So America's basically trying to drive somewhat of a wedge between Russia and Iran.
Right. This is what the Daily Beast talked about in this article as the big gamble, cleaving Russia from Iran, is trying to split the two up, and then the United States would be happier for the power figure behind the Assad regime or whatever regime's in power to be Russia rather than Iran. They're probably right on that. It is a danger also because it's acknowledging that Russia's power in Syria, that is there to stay, and that's part of American policy now. Remember, Russia wasn't there 3 years ago or two years ago. Then they came in, joined the fight. Now it looks like it's paying dividends because the United States is accepting that Russia will stay there from now on.
This also basically leaves Bashar Assad in power.
At least for the time being, it does. And I think we'll see more come out about that. And that will be basically reliant upon Assad himself. Is Assad willing to go along with the United States and Russia in what they would like to do, which means ensuring that not all of the Syrian state goes back into Assad's hands? That's part of this deal that they're working out, that the areas claimed by allies of the United States fighting in Syria, Syrians that are fighting against Islamic State, that those territories that they win, they do not go back to Assad. they will not be part of his future power base. That's what Russia wants. That's what the United States wants. Assad wants all of Syria back to himself. Mm-hmm. But what the United States is trying to is hoping for is that Russia will out be able to pressure Assad to keep a smaller territory in Syria and then have de facto territories belonging to Syrians not underneath the umbrella of Assad.
Very interesting. Before we move on, I'd like to throw one other story at you this week. The Washington Free Beacon reported Trump administration officials saying they've actually been authorized to begin taking military measures to protect American interests in Syria. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yeah, this is something we have seen begin to take place over the past month or so. And it became official where the United States has given the green light in any case where they are attacked by any Iranian backed group, be it Hezbollah, the IRGC, or other Iranian forces there, that the United States is going to take swift action to protect their soldiers. Again, this didn't happen under President Obama. And again, this is a way that the United States is pushing back against Iran and Syria and then holding out their hand to Russia, saying, no, we're accepting you to help us, you know, with Syria's future.
All right. Well, thank you, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Probably the splashiest headlines to come out of the G20 summit that started today in Hamburg, Germany, are the violent protests that have taken place there with anti-capitalist activists hurling bottles and stones. Quite a lot of tumult there in advance of this summit taking place. Not totally unusual. The G20 tends to stir up quite a lot of controversy when it meets together. But to learn about what's going on there, we're going to go back to Jerusalem to Kieran Underwood.
Thank you. The biggest headline that I saw, or the most repeated headline that I saw on this, was actually that violent protests left Melania Trump unable to join the G20 events. So they focused on the Trump angle of this. But of course, I saw the Australian Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, locked up in a room with, I think it was the Indonesian president. So there was a lot of other people who couldn't get to the events, people blocked from getting to where they needed to be. There was nearly 20,000 police officers who were in Hamburg, Germany, which is the second largest city in Germany, has about 1.8 million people there. So there was about 20,000 police, thousands and thousands of anti-capitalist protesters.
I actually saw a sign, an article that said it was up to 100,000 protesters.
Yeah, they think there will be up to 100,000 over the weekend. So I'm not sure there's 100,000 yet, but those are the predicted numbers. So in a city of 1.8 million people, to have 100,000 protesters on the street, that's huge. That's like nearly 1 in 20 people on your street has gone to the anti-capitalist protests. Of course, there's people coming in from other cities as well. But there's videos of the police coming in with water cannons, people trying to block streets, being sprayed, and of course, you know, fights breaking out and all the usual things that happen at anti-government protests.
So this is something that we do tend to see associated with the G20, these anti-globalization activists, environmentalists, trade unions, people who are basically opposed to what they perceive as the apex of the capitalist system. Is there any sense that, say, this movement is gaining ground in light of, say, the socialist movements within some European countries, maybe even the Pope and the statements that he's come out against the capitalist system? It seems like there is this kind of movement away from capitalism and toward alternative economic models.
Well, that's exactly what I thought when I saw the anti-capitalist headline. Not that there wasn't this this underlying thread going on before, but the Pope's comments really in the past year or two, coming out and saying that, you know, capitalism is the reason why this world has so many problems, and a new world government, a new system has to be put in place. I mean, I'm surely in Germany, those comments are the types of ones which people latch onto. So I was thinking, as soon as I saw that headline, that's definitely the Pope definitely has a big influence there. And then also, I mean, you have these two factions. You have these far right factions who are very, very vocal. And then on the other side, you have the reactions, the leftist reactions, the anti-globalist. And of course, at the same time, you have a lot of people joining in who are for climate action, climate change, all these what you'd probably call a second type of protest. Those who are looking at the G20 and seeing President Trump coming in.
After having just withdrawn America from the Paris Climate Accord.
Exactly. Exactly right. He's saying he's liking the more protectionist rhetoric. He doesn't want to intervene with climate, giving money to climate change. So you have then a second part of these protesters, the climate change activists as well.
Very interesting. We appreciate that, Kieran. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about a massive trade deal that was made just before the G20 summit. That is between the European Union and Japan. We'll talk about Austria deploying armored vehicles to keep immigrants out of its country. Yet another shameful United Nations ruling against the Jewish state of Israel, and the Trump administration's new budget that increases this year's deficit over last year's by $18 billion. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
On Thursday, the day before the G20 summit started today, the European Union and Japan announced a major agreement that will lower trade barriers between these two on pretty much everything. This is a deal with major economic implications and prophetic implications. For this story, we're going to go back to Sam Livingston.
Thank you. Just as you said there, before the G20, Japan and the EU announced this new trade deal. It's called the Japan-EU Economic Partnership Agreement, and I'm really growing fond of these acronyms. I'm calling this one JEPA, J-E-E-P-A. They're really rushing to push this along since the United States backed out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. Mm-hmm. So now Japan is scurrying around trying to find another partner, and they found it in the European Union. This new trade deal cuts Japanese tariffs on products like beef and pork and wine. The emphasis being on bringing more European food products to Japan and more Japanese cars to Europe. Right now, the European Union has a 10% tariff on cars coming in from Japan. This new deal would phase that out over the next 7 years. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said the announcement was the birth of the world's largest free advanced industrialized economic zone. Between these two countries, there is 30% of global trade circulating just between Japan and the European Union. So this is a very big trade deal. It hasn't been approved by both of the countries yet. They've announced it, but they're hoping to push it through within the next few months. Like I said, they're rushing to get this along. The Washington Post ran an article titled, "Japan and Europe Counter Trump with Colossal Trade Deal." On Thursday, Japan took on the mantle of the global rules-based trading system. They went on to say, this deal will be a heavy blow to American producers of these goods by making U.S.-made goods relatively more expensive and less competitive in the major markets of Japan and Europe. So here's this rising counter-trade alliance between the European Union and Japan. What's really exciting about this is what Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has written about this. You can read about it in the Isaiah booklet, and I think what's even more exciting about that is the copyright on that book is 2011. So this is well before any of these things are being discussed in the news, Japan and the EU having a trade alliance. Just a few quotes from that book. Again, the latest copyright date is 2011. He says, China and Japan are trading mightily with the Holy Roman Empire or the European Union. Two great trading blocks are positioning themselves to control the world. That is the European Union and the kings of the East are Russia, China, and Japan. He says, we believe there may be a brief alliance between the German-led Holy Roman Empire and certain Asian powers, Russia, China, and Japan. So you're seeing that happen, and just in very a tangible way now with these trade deals opening up. And it will be slow at the start, but the fact that we're seeing Japan and the EU so eager to move this along, to push this through, in light of what's going on with the United States and Donald Trump's protectionist policies. There was one, that title again from the Washington Post really jumped out at me because they're countering the United States of America. This is to counter Donald Trump. So this is being done because America can't be relied on. They're being pushed off of the scene. Even this week, Germany's foreign minister, Sigmar Gabriel, said, this was just before the G20 meetings began. He said, there are things that cause great concern that the United States could start a trade war with Europe. So those war bells are ringing when it comes to the economy. And to read more about that, there's Mr. McDonald's piece. I think that was two trumpet issues ago, titled Trade Wars Have Begun. And now we're really seeing this come to fruition.
Well, you covered that very thoroughly, Sam. Thank you. I don't have any questions for you. That is quite dramatic. If listeners want to go and read those statements from that Isaiah booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, you can find that on thetrumpet.com under the literature tab. And it is quite extraordinary. We've been watching for this for quite a while, and we've been seeing more of the trade relationship develop between the European Union and, say, China, and overtures between Germany and Russia. It seems like this is certainly the most dramatic instance of collusion between the European Union and Japan. But really, when you consider the amount of goods, the size of the markets that we're talking about, this really does have dramatic implications for trade worldwide, and certainly pointing at that prophecy that Gerald Fleury's drawn attention to makes it very, very interesting to watch. We appreciate that, Sam. We also next are going to talk about a dramatic development in Europe's migrant crisis. The number of immigrants coming across the Mediterranean from Libya into Europe remains very high, over 10,000 per month this year. Austria says that it's going to start taking more serious action. It has actually begun deploying armored vehicles near its border with Italy. The government even announced plans to send soldiers to prevent immigrants from coming into the country. To learn more about this, we're going to go back to Kieran Underwood.
Yes, that was the statement from the Austrian government on Tuesday this week, that they were going to send four armored vehicles there, and they in the future would be sending up to 750 soldiers to go down to the Italian border to make sure that those migrants would stay in Italy and be processed in Italy instead of coming into Austria. Now, the Austrians, they're going to have an election, and it's coming up in October. And just like the Germans and the Dutch, they do not want their far-right parties to be able to use security and immigration against them to say, look, the government who's over us is being too lax about this. So they want to put forward some measures that look like they're cracking down on the immigration which is coming through their southern border. Now, I think the reason why this is so important for Austria is that in 2015, when the migrant crisis was making news, the biggest news in Europe, they took in 1% of their population as migrants coming in. So 1% of their population in just 1 year. And this year, from Libya to Italy, coming through the Mediterranean, there have been over 85,000 rescued and brought into Italy. So you have 85,000 refugees in Italy waiting to kind of pour in through north. Austria is a really big target for them, and Austria wants to make sure that none of them get in. Now, the reason that they're coming through Italy and trying to come through Austria is because The EU has finally been was finally able to shut down that route, which was coming from Turkey. Initially in 2015, the migrants, the refugees were coming from the Middle East, were coming from Africa, and they're all flowing through this route, which was in Turkey, flowing through Turkey to Europe. Merkel, Chancellor Merkel was able to do a deal with Turkey in March 2016 to shut off that route. And you had, initially in 2016, you had about 1,400 refugees coming in every week through that Turkish route. And now in 2017, you only have around 27 a week coming through. So they completely shut off that route. And now a lot more of them are coming through that Libyan-Italian route. And Austria is thinking, we need to shut that off as well.
It's quite interesting to see Austria making this move, basically saying, we're going to look after our own. I mean, we talked about the just the shakiness of the Schengen zone, this idea that Europe has had that we're just going to have one big area, basically one border around the entire thing. And as this becomes a bigger issue, now you have more and more European countries saying, well, we can't trust European Union restrictions to protect ourselves. We're just going to put up the wall right on our own border. We're gonna defend ourselves with armored vehicles. We're going to put troops on our own border. And essentially, Austria is saying, look, Italy, this is your problem, aren't they?
They're saying that's your problem, and they're saying, we don't really care about the principle of free movement right now. Germany has said the same thing in the past a couple of times. France doesn't want any people coming through their borders. And Italy countering with some rhetoric when those armored vehicles came down to the border said, you guys are violating the Schengen Agreement. And that's the accusation that a lot of countries have had, but at the end of the day, they don't really care. They say, oh, well, I don't care if I have to take these temporary measures to save my own country. So you see this really, really unstable at the moment, European Union with the migrant crisis.
Yeah, it's an interesting development in this crisis that we've been watching unfold here for a few years now. And I would expect that, you know, at some point, the way that the migrants are pushing against them and the way that we're seeing this erupt in acts of terror, that we've seen some of these migrants specifically who have committed acts of terror in Europe, that they are going to have to take bolder measures as a unified unit, or this really is something that could end up tearing the whole European Union project apart unless they manage it very robustly as a unit. Well, we appreciate that, Kieran. Earlier we talked about the G20. We're going to talk now about another international body, the United Nations, UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, has ruled that a significant religious site in Israel, the Cave of the Patriarchs, is actually a Palestinian heritage site. It's quite a provocative ruling by UNESCO, although it's really not too different from the anti-Israel bent that they have shown time and time again, but really something that has Israel up in arms. For this story, we're going to go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is the first time ever that the UNESCO group has recognized a significant religious site as part of the state of Palestine, not as a historic site in Israel. This is according to most of the members of UNESCO, the state of Palestine. And Hebron there is the old city of Hebron is a very important location for both Muslims and also Jews and Christians, I might add as well, because right there in the old city is you have this Herodian era structure built over the double cave where the patriarchs were buried. Everybody remembers, or many people could remember the story of Abraham having to purchase the cave when his wife died and then buried her there. And then both Abraham, I believe Isaac, Rachel, Sarah, Jacob, they were all buried in this tomb as well, which is in Hebron. And UNESCO comes out and says that this is a religious site, the Cave of the Patriarchs. We're going to show that it is on a World Heritage Site, and it's in the state of Palestine. And yet also in their resolution, what they chose to focus on was not the Abrahamic era history, was not anything about the Israelite or pre-Israelite Hebrew leaders that were buried there, but rather on the Ibrahim Mosque that has since been built in that location, the fourth holiest site in Islam. But it pretty much does away or doesn't really focus on at all the fact that this is the second holiest site after Jerusalem to the Jews. And
so again, effectively rewriting history completely.
Yeah, rewriting history, delegitimizing Israel's claim, historic claim to this patch of earth. Hebron's one of quite a large city in southern Israel, and it does kind of follow on, as you said, other agreements or resolutions that UNESCO has made. And again, people could blow this off and say, who cares what UNESCO thinks? And I say that is an illegitimate question to have. What does it matter what UNESCO says? Well, it's just this, it's a growing movement just throughout the world.
Just on that point, I think the Israel's ambassador to UNESCO made an interesting point when after they announced this decision. He was there at the UNESCO meeting where they made this decision. He said, took out his cell phone, said, "Mr. Chairman, it's my plumber in my apartment in Paris. There's a huge problem in my toilet, and it's a lot more important than the decision that you just adopted." So that basically saying this is how much credence Israel is going to give to this decision.
Right. And that's exactly right. What happened in the United States and Canada, I believe Australia, came out and gave statements talking about how ludicrous this is. And yet you have many nations in the world, 12 countries, actually 12 of the 21 members actually approved of this, 3 objected, 6 abstained. So this is passing. World public opinion deems now that Hebron is part of a state of Palestine. Come to Israel, visit Hebron. See if it's part of the state of Palestine or still is part of the state of Israel. Take a look at that site. Why are you there? Why is the Ibrahim Mosque even built in that location? Mm-hmm. Because they have a little bit of reverence for Abraham or Ibrahim. They're also some of the other patriarchs. And yet UNESCO doesn't focus on that. They focus on this being a Palestinian religious site.
You put this in context with the rulings that the United Nations made against Israel last year when they were talking about the 1967 borders and essentially establishing a de facto Palestinian state absent any negotiations, essentially sidestepping the entire peace process and unilaterally declaring that this is the case. This is right along the same line of reasoning, isn't it?
Yeah, it declares the Israeli-Palestinian peace process over. Even the old city of Jerusalem, which was beyond the Six-Day War lines, that was inside Jordanian territory. Therefore, it should belong to the Palestinians. In fact, it does right now, according to them. And so Israel, if you're conducting any excavations, archaeological excavations in that territory, you're breaking the law. And we're going to hopefully do something about it. They can't do much, but the Palestinian spokesman came out, even in light of this recent decision. There was another one actually on Jerusalem we're not going to talk about on Wednesday. But this Palestinian spokesman came out and called on the international community to, quote, enforce these decisions on the ground in order to lift injustice, oppression, domination practiced by the occupying power against our steadfast people in the city of Jerusalem and against its Islamic and Christian holy places. Come, visit Jerusalem. I've been touring Jerusalem with some students today. We could access every site if we wanted to, apart from the Al-Aqsa Mosque, apart from the Dome of the Rock, the Haram el-Sharif. We couldn't get in because it's Friday. But They aren't destroyed by Israel. And yet, if you go back to the times when Muslim powers occupied Jerusalem, they frequently destroyed synagogues. They destroyed other religious sites. So if anyone wants to call out or wants to is for the preservation of historic sites of all religions, the nation that has proved to do that has been Israel. And yet the UNESCO did say that this site was not only Palestinian, but it's endangered. Endangered. By who? By who? Who's putting it in danger? Right. Israel isn't putting it in danger. They're the ones that are ensuring its safekeeping. Anyhow, it is ludicrous, but it just the constant headlines down this road, the constant reports of state of Palestine, these sites being undermined by Israel, it rubs off on world public opinion.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, a Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. One final story here before our lightning round. On Tuesday, President Donald Trump sent Congress a $4.1 trillion spending plan. He says it's going to balance the government's books over the next decade. There are a lot of people decrying the supposedly draconian cuts that he's proposing, but those cuts aren't exactly as steep as some people would have you believe. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, this is definitely a record America keeps breaking, but it seems like each year the budget just keeps getting bigger. And this will be the first time in U.S. history that the budget's actually passed the $4 trillion mark. And as you mentioned, I guess before I get into that, I'll mention that I said the reason it's passed the $4 trillion mark is President Trump, he's increased defense spending by up to 10%. He's increased Homeland Security spending 7%. He's increased Veterans Affairs up to 6%. Most other programs, I mean, the media coverage focuses on that he's cutting. And like I said, they mentioned that, oh, all these draconian cuts, and you hear more claims like, well, this is going to take food away from the poor and take medical away from the elderly and all this, but it kind of glosses over the fact that, or if you don't read closely, you could be forgiven for not knowing this, is they're not actually real cuts. They're cuts in the projected budget. So American entitlement spending is still going to be higher in 2017 than it was in 2016, but it's not going to be as high by 2026 as we thought previously. It'd be kind of like if I planned on spending $1,000 on electricity next year as opposed to, say, $500 I spent this year and decided to only spend $700 instead of saying, oh, wow, I'm spending $200 more on electricity. You're saying, oh, I saved $300 because I'm spending less next year than I originally thought I was going to spend. That's basically
political accounting. It kind of plays by its own rules, doesn't it?
Right. It's basically U.S. entitlement spending. We're still spending more on entitlements, just not as much more as was previously planned, which is why you can still talk about budget cuts, even though the budget actually gets bigger every year.
So are there some what are some of the things that he's actually planning to cut? If he's raising defense, he's raising Homeland Security and some of the Veterans Affairs, some of those, the things that really tend to make the hearts of conservatives sing. What are some of the ones that really are the knife in the heart for the liberals?
Well, the knife in the heart one is definitely Environmental Protection Agency. And again, like I said, it's not that we're actually spending less on environmental protection than we are right now. We're just not going to spend as much on it in 10 years as we thought. But that's definitely the one that's got the biggest cuts in the projected budget was the Environmental Protection Agency. But some of the other ones are like the Agriculture Department, the Labor Department, transportation, education, housing and urban development.
A lot of the bureaucracies that basically popped up in the 20th century, FDR and the progressive movement.
Right. Things that would have been handled by the states before in the 1920s and before, and have now been co-opted by the federal government. He's not actually cutting those programs. And you with a $4 trillion budget, you could make an argument that some of those programs actually should probably get some real cuts, but he's definitely slowing down how fast they're growing.
Is it projected to pass Congress?
That's always a good question these days, isn't it? But I think it is, but it's though most of the a lot of the healthcare bills were projected to pass Congress too, and that's proven a little more difficult than originally thought.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep our eyes on it. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Visit us online at thetrumpet.com. We really try to get the stories that we talk about on the program here on the website. You can read those articles there. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention this week, and we'll start with Brent.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi was in Israel this week meeting with Israeli officials and Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu. They signed a number of agreements, including fields includes the fields of technology, water, and agriculture. This is actually the first time that an Indian prime minister has come to Israel since the country's established diplomatic ties 25 years ago.
And we'll go to Sam.
On July 4th, President Xi Jinping finished up his visit to Russia. The Chinese president told Russian media that the two nations are currently at their best time in history. Just more evidence that Russia and China are working together and they're molding global affairs.
And Andrew.
Pope Francis appointed a new prefect for the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith this week. In an unusual move, the Pope chose not to reappoint German Cardinal Gerhard Müller to a second five-year term as the Vatican's chief doctrine enforcer. Instead, the Vatican announced Saturday that the Pope had chosen Jesuit theologian Louis Ladaria to head the department once known as the Office of the Holy Inquisition. Rumors that Miller was going to be removed have been swirling for over a year now, and Ladaria will be the first Jesuit to ever hold this office.
All right. Over to Kieran.
The G20 summit started today and will continue tomorrow, but thousands of Germans who have protested and were given polls actually don't believe the G20 will actually solve any of their problems. When asked if it would solve the world's most important problems, 70% of those Germans responded, no, not in any way, and only 20% believed that it could solve any problems at all.
Sounds like a reasonable position. We'll go back to Brent.
Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt expressed their regret over Qatar's negative response to their list of 13 demands for restoring relations. They expressed that regret on Wednesday. The foreign ministers of those four countries said the political and economic embargo on the small Gulf nation will continue, but no new sanctions have been announced. The fact that Qatar looks to be digging in is not a positive sign for the Gulf states. This boycott was intended to coerce Qatar away from its warming relations with Iran, but it looks like it is threatening to make them even closer with Iran.
All right, back to Sam.
Two United States bombers flew over the disputed South China Sea this morning. China's foreign ministry said China resolutely opposes individual countries using the banner of freedom of navigation and overflight to flaunt military force and harm China's sovereignty and security. So China views this territory as its own. This incident this morning should make for a good talking point between Donald Trump and the Chinese president as they're scheduled to meet today at the G20 summit.
One last item from Andrew.
Great Britain reduced carbon dioxide emissions by 27% between 2005 and 2015, according to the government's latest data release. At present, Britain is committed to reducing such emissions by 80% by 2050. Yet a report from Leeds Reversity reveals that the main way Britain has accomplished this milestone is by moving its manufacturing activities overseas. So while British attempts to combat climate change may have not helped the planet much, they have certainly helped the Chinese economy.
I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories that we talked about on today's program. You can also give us your feedback by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much to this panel of gentlemen here, Andrew Miller, Sam Livingston, Kieran Underwood, and Brent Nachtigall.
Great to be here.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. Good dudes. I'll leave you with the words of John Wooden. Fairness is giving all people the treatment they earn and deserve. It doesn't mean treating everyone alike. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.